The book of Job is a difficult story about a righteous man who endures incredible suffering. Job, a man who lives a life by wisely fearing God, only to be rewarded with what appears to be God's judgment. How come Job suffers in such a horrible way? How did Job's counseling friends misapply wisdom? When Job finally has a chance to meet with God, it seems that God just beats Job down. Why does the Lord do this? What can possibly be the point of this book? What can this book teach us about wisdom?
Well, as we join together, we know that Job has gone through some trials, if we could put it mildly. That's probably the understatement of the year. The reality is this man has been one of the greatest, as Job, the narrative or the prologue tells us, one of the greatest of the sons of the East. I mean, to put it in context, in our day and age, he'd be a guy who would be on the Fortune 500 list, and he'd probably be one of the top 10 on that list. Job's not one who could just buy what he wants, but he's one who can actually go and have custom things made. I mean, he's a guy where there is nothing that is outside the realm of possibility in terms of his prestige and wealth. That's the setting, and I think that needs to be impressed upon us. And the thing about Job is the presentation doesn't seem that this man has really had that hard of a life. But he hasn't really suffered a whole lot. He doesn't really know what it is like to struggle. It's important to remember who's trying to basically bring this war, this strife, or this struggle upon Job. It's Satan. Satan making the wager to the living God that I could get this man to curse you to your face. That's the wager. That's the goal. That's the desired outcome. And the Lord says, my servant will never curse me. Take from him everything you will. And we get to the point where even Satan can begin to harm Job's flesh. And Job is one who has just been spewing forth his own righteousness, his own hope in himself. And what I like about this speech in chapter 16 is after Eliphaz has told Job that really Job doesn't have wisdom either. Job claims they have no wisdom, but he says, well, where's your wisdom? Did you meet with the gods? Did you meet in the council of heaven? Are you like Isaiah who came down from the council with the word of the Lord? Well, no. And so has Eliphaz finally gotten through to Job that Job cannot stand in the midst, in the presence of the living, holy God, claiming his own righteousness, and based on his own righteousness, God is bound to hear his case, and God is then supposed to admit he was wrong in bringing this against Job. Do you understand the offense of where Job is going with this? He's not cursing God to God's face, that's true. But he's getting to a place where Job is starting to place himself over the living God. Is Job going to cling to this position, or is the Lord going to break him? Well, we find in the raising of this, basically I've divided it into, or I'm not, other commentators as well, have divided this speech into at least four sections. Others have gone as far as six, but I like four. And basically, if you look at this, you have a counseling conspiracy where Job rebukes the counselors for what they have said. You have a counseling complacency where Job is upset at how they have treated him. Counseling consequences and what's going to come upon them. And lastly, counseling complications where Job is coming to grips with his own life. And so the counseling conspiracy, basically verses 1 through 6. The Job now, Eliphaz, as we mentioned, kicked off this next series of speeches, or the second cycle of Job. And as Eliphaz kicks off the second cycle of speeches, you have Job now responding to this man. And he's responding and saying, basically, he said, leave me alone. Initially, leave me alone. I want to just bring my case to God. You guys stop talking. Be silent. Let that be your wisdom. But Eliphaz said, no, that's not going to be our wisdom. And Job now turns to these counselors and says, you know, this really could have gone in a different direction. You guys could have come here, you could have heard me out, you could have talked with me, and maybe we could have built our case together against the Lord. You see, their counsel, as Job says, is miserable. Miserable counselors are you all. I think it's important to remember that in Job 2:11, last time we find these counselors or this comforting that they desired to do was in Job 2:11, where these three men, desired to come together to offer words of consolation to their friend. That is what they were doing. Well, Job says, I wish you guys would have stayed home, because your task in trying to do this as you set out, you failed. And you failed miserably. You have not helped me at all. But he now talks about Eliphaz. And again, this wind is something that we find throughout the narrative. Last time they said Job is like the east wind. Remember, that's that strong, intense wind. Not quite hurricane force, but nearly hurricane force. Very hot. Basically consumes and almost kills everything in its path. You can definitely notice plant life and things after the east winds have come, that they've withered and they've experienced the pain of those winds. That's what they said Job was. Job isn't even flattering these men that way. He's saying, you guys are just full of wind. You're just blowing wind around. You're just making noise like a wind. You're not really doing anything. Nothing's really organized. Nothing's even coming of what you're doing. So please leave me alone. Because he's saying, the more you talk, the windier it gets in this area. So please stop. I'm tired of being in the midst of this dust cloud, if you will. Now as he goes on, as Job is laying this out, there is something that's good. That Job recognizes that there's a problem in this system. Because notice that he goes on in verse 4 to now hypothetically say, well, if you guys were in this situation, I would do this. That Job is basically saying he could bring comforting words. He could bring words of solace, words of peace, words that would take away their pain and be a suave and basically make it so they didn't hurt so badly. See, the good thing in this is Job is finally starting to realize the fundamental system that they embrace is flawed. They embrace a system, we'd say in our day and age, along the lines of a health and wealth gospel. The more faithful you are to the Lord, the more He's going to bless you. The less faithful you are to God, the more He's going to curse you. And that's basically what these men have laid out. And Job has to come to grips with the reality that he's not blessed because he is so good, so righteous in and of himself. He's blessed because God, by His providential care, has blessed him. So now it seems that in the midst of this struggle, Job is being sanctified to a place where he's recognizing maybe this gospel means more than what we thought, or this covenant of grace of this God who comes to his people. Maybe there's something more there we haven't explored as deeply as we ought to. And so Job then basically tells the counselors, here's a fundamental problem. You've come together, you've conspired against me, you've tried to harm me. Instead of building a case with me before God to talk about my righteousness, you have done nothing but bring a bunch of wind, a windstorm, and blow up a bunch of dust, and there's no consolation or hope in your words. We need to think about something else. Because Job goes on to talk about the counseling complacency, basically in 16 verses 7 through 17, if your Bibles are still open. But he's talking about the reality of what's happened. Now, verse 7, granted, this is one of those things where the original text is a little bit difficult to discern and understand exactly what's being stated there. Now, again, this shouldn't rattle our faith. Sometimes we hear that and we wonder, well, what does that mean? We've never found anything where a text isn't absolutely clear in terms of the original language, that it's basically altered a major Christian doctrine. But we can get the gist of what Job is saying in verse 7. What Job is saying in verse 7 is that God is not making his life easy. And I think it's important to remember who's causing this pain in Job's mind. Again, he's not moving beyond this understanding. For Job, his adversary, the one who's against him, is God. There is no other adversary. It's only God versus Job. And so the thing to remember in this, if we put this in contemporary terms, it's Job wanting his case against the state, if you will, that he wants to have the impossible trial. Rather than it being the state, it's Job trying to make his case in the heavenly assembly, in the heavenly council that we saw at the beginning of Job's book with the prologue of Satan presenting himself. We saw how the angels in heaven are there before God presenting their reports. Job wants this situation. Job wants this case to be heard. But the problem with his counselors then is that when he looks at what God has done, God has basically broken him. And you look at verses 8 and 9, the language that's there, it's not very nice, shriveled me up. This is what's a witness against me. In other words, as he suffers, it testifies that he's a sinner deserving the suffering of God. So God's made him like those who are accursed, and Job doesn't like that. We find that he's torn me in his wrath. He's hated me. He's gnashed his teeth at me. The force of that would be, you know, when you go on someone's property and a dog runs out and starts showing its teeth and growling and barking at you, you know that if you're smart, you stay put and you wait for the owner to call this animal off you. That's what Job is saying God has done. It's like he's encountered this wild animal who's come against him and is gnashing his teeth and wants nothing more than to destroy him. And as Job experiences this and he sees how God is the one who continues to attack him, he's noting again who God is, his adversary. 6 verse 23, it was the adversary who comes against God, or comes against Job. And again, it's God. And when he talks about God fixating his eyes and having his eyes trained on Job, the force of that would be like in our day and age, we could talk about a sniper who's a good shot. That his eyes are trained on the target, waiting for the command to take out the target. That his eyes are fixated on where he's supposed to make the shot. But when Job talks about God's eyes being trained on him, it's God watching him from up high, as we would say normally, like a sniper in our day and age, would be in a position of significance or a position where he can look down on his target and take a clear shot. Job's saying that's what God's like, but when he presents him as a wild animal, when a sniper takes someone out, it's usually a clean shot. What Job's saying with God and what God's doing is that God's not going to do a clean shot. God's basically training his army on him. God's coming against him like an animal, and it's going to be a rather violent and gruesome death. And Job is wondering, why is this happening? And what have the counselors done? They haven't turned to Job and said, cling to your Lord. Cling to your faith, Job. There's something going on we don't understand, but cling to your Lord. Don't give up. Don't see him as the adversary. You're not understanding the whole situation. No. Job has a proper grievance against the counselors. He's saying, you're hanging me out to dry. Here I am alone, trying to sort out who God is and what he's doing against me and why I have this target on my back against such a ruthless predator. And you guys do nothing to encourage me. You do nothing to help me. And he's presenting it as he's going to war and his vital organs are being cut open in front of him. And it gets absolutely gruesome when you look at this. And that's the force of what Job is saying. This really hurts, and the depth of the pain is so deep and so degrading, you have no idea what I'm going through and what I feel. But who is Job? This is where we see Job once again, talking about who Job is. Verses 16 and 17. He's crying out. He's weeping. He's broken. And what about him? Again, what does he appeal to? There's no violence in my hands. My prayer is pure. In other words, Job is saying, but I've done nothing wrong, guys. And the reality is, Job is right. That's the very reason why this test comes about, because Job is pure, righteous, and holy before the Lord. And God is one who is calling his attention, or calling Job to Satan's attention, saying, have you considered my servant? And as we've said before, this is the fundamental problem with Job. Job is pure, righteous, and holy. Job thinks he is worthy or has contributed or has a significance in and of himself in terms of his life that we find, ironically, the Lord has sent Satan upon this man to rid Job of this sin of self-righteousness, that Job, within the core of his being, thinks that he is righteous before the Lord. But the Lord saying, no one's righteous enough. Now we find the consequences of this in verses 18 basically through 17:5. That as the counselors are complacent and not helping Job in this, he's talking about the consequences of what's happened and where he's going. Notice now that it does become rather ironic. That as Job talks about who they are, He doesn't want his lifeblood to go into the earth. Now, this is a significant concept. You know, we read about this in John's Gospel of Christ saying, eat of my body, drink of my blood. The blood is the life. It's the very life that keeps the animal or the organism alive. And so this is why Israel was not to drink of the blood of the sacrifices in Israel, and the blood was to be separated from the animal, because the Lord didn't want Israel to look to that animal for life, but wanted Israel to look beyond the animal to the Lord for life. This is where when Christ says, drink of my blood, there's significance there. He's saying, life only comes by consuming me and my spirit and the life that I pour out for you. So Job now is saying, if my blood is poured out into the ground, my life is done. There's nothing left of me, no memory. He's saying, what happens? His case falls flat. His case is finished. There's no chance for him to go into heaven, because what does he go on to say? He wants his witness to be in heaven. He wants someone in heaven to be this advocate, to make this case for him in the midst of the heavenly assembly, like we saw with Satan entering into the presence of God in the prologue. He's saying, if only there's one that can do this before I die. But he goes on to talk about the frustration in this. His friends are those who scorn him. His friends are those who have not done their job. They're complacent again and encouraging him. And as a result of this, Job is saying, I'm going to die. Nobody's there to make my case for me, and my blood is going to sink into the ground, and there will be no memory left of me, and that's it. He says, the years come, the years go, what's left? Now in 17:3, he makes this proposal. He proposes a solution. And the solution when he talks about a pledge, now basically this would be like a wager. The wager based between God and Satan is that if this man turns against God, well then God's no longer going to be God because he can't fulfill his promises. So that's basically the pledge you could see there in the initial setting of this book in the prologue. But this pledge is basically, say I want to go to court, or I think somebody has wronged me. Now, if I have money or I have my house, say I put my house up. And I say, if I'm right, I keep my house and I may receive something from the other person. If I'm wrong, that person can take my house and that's the result and the outcome of this trial. And so it's basically a way of initiating a lawsuit. You know, in our day and age, it'd be like you have to pay the legal costs of the other attorney or the other party. That would be along these lines. And so Job is saying, I want to put something up before God. I have to pledge something. And the pledge that he wants to put before God, if you look at the context of this, is a problem. Because it's Job's own righteousness. The purity of his prayer. The purity of his actions. The purity of his desire. That's the pledge. And so basically he's saying, I'm willing to put my righteousness on the line to have my case with God. So if God deems me guilty, then I will abandon myself of all my righteousness. And I will admit my guilt. But if I win, then the Lord basically is one who's going to have to owe Job an apology. Again, not cursing God to his face, but you see a problem here. Job is putting himself at least on equals with God or maybe above God. And Job's going to continue to explore this potential avenue. And so Job then, with the consequences of this counseling and what they're doing, is they haven't encouraged Job with another direction, another option. Job's basically backed into a corner. His only option is to put this pledge before God, to enter into court with God, and to plead his case. That's it. And now Job goes on to talk about the complications of this when you look in 17:6 through 16. Because what has happened? Well, Job doesn't look good. And that's the reality of it. Job is saying, look at who I am. I'm a man who's broken. A man that when people look upon me, they see me as a wicked man. The upright laugh at me. They scoff at me. They claim that he has nothing. And Job says, so how does one who looks like I do claim a righteousness in the presence of God? And the reality of Job is that he's saying, look, my days are getting shorter. My days are getting dimmer. The reality is, he's saying, as this trial continues, as I experience this affliction, I'm not going to last very long. And he talks about the dread of what's going to happen. You know, he's basically, again, appealing to the creation when you look at 17:12. That is, night and day are going to get mixed up, where he's no longer going to have the light of day. Again, you think about language like the eighth day, 50, things like this. The new day, a new day of redemption, a new day of hope. Joe's saying, I don't see a day of hope anymore. My days are all becoming night. And he says, if my only hope is Sheol, and I think, again, this is significant when you think about where he started, chapter 3, in his initial speeches. He says, if my home is Sheol, and that's my place of rest, what do I have? If I say to the pit, you are my father, and I say to the worm, you are my mother. This, again, is a rather gruesome picture. This is basically when one goes into the grave and their body is consumed by the worms. It's consumed and it no longer exists. So Job is saying, not only will he be wiped out from under the sun, and he'll be confined to Sheol, but he's saying even his body, even the evidence of a man who walked on this earth called Job, is going to disappear. And he's saying, if these are my parents, what hope do I have? He doesn't want to notice in verse 16 that wonderful question. Will I go down to the bars of Sheol? In other words, a prison of death. Shall we descend together into the dust? Job is basically saying, is this it for life? You live, you suffer, you die, and that's it. Now here's something Job needs to remember. And he should know this. When the first martyr was executed and killed by his brother Cain, what did the Lord call as evidence into his courtroom when he had called Cain to account? He gave Cain a chance to confess. So where's your brother? Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? Am I supposed to keep tabs on him? The Lord doesn't answer that. He says, Cain, your brother's blood, your brother's life is crying out to me from the ground. And so here you have that wonderful presentation of God calling this man to account, where you think if you just kill this brother, his testimony will be silent and this God will no longer be able to look over Cain and to judge Cain. But the Lord's saying to Cain, you missed something. I'm the Lord of life. The lives of my saints mean something. When Job is going on and saying, if only there's this advocate to make my case, that if I go down into Sheol, may there be one who can stand in the counsel of the living God and plead my case. What is Job missing? He's missing the reality that there is one who stands in the counsel of God and he pleads our case, and it's not a pledge of our righteousness that stands there before the Lord. It's his righteousness. It's the resurrected Christ. What Job and the counselors miss in these narratives, and Job's getting close, not quite there yet, but they're missing the cross-shaped logic of suffering to glory. And Job thinking that if he goes into Sheol, his life is done. There's nothing there. That's it. God cannot do anything more. But he fails to see that the Lord's love, as you can read in the Psalms, is deeper than Sheol. The Lord's love goes deeper than the sea. The Lord's love for his people can go down into the belly and pit of Sheol and bring his people up into life. You see, this is an important lesson in the book of Job. I think we miss a lot as Christians. And one, I think we can see that the Lord wants us to be very authentic in our prayers before him, to express our frustrations, to want to be informed by his wisdom. I think that's one thing. But I think another thing that we learn from this book is we fail to see how important and significant the gospel is. Because what is Job fundamentally saying? Guys, I hope this gospel message is true. I hope there's truth, that there's one who stands in the midst of heaven and pleads my case on my behalf, because that'd be great. What Job fails to see is that gospel message is true. What I also find rather ironic that dawned on me this week. Satan says to the Lord, you test this man, you tempt this man, he will curse you to your face. I always wondered, why does the Lord single this man out? This man's righteous if he loves the Lord. Now, we can see that the Lord wants to break him of his righteousness. That's true. But what's the means the Lord uses to break Job of his righteousness? Here's the irony that testifies to God's sovereignty and how our God gets the last laugh. He's using Satan, who wants to undermine God's plan of redemption, to build up his plan of redemption. He's using Satan to sanctify his saint, to break him of his own righteousness. So the saint recognizes, I can go into Sheol and the hand of my Lord will not leave me. I can go into the pit and the belly of death and my Lord's hand will not abandon me. My blood can be spilled on the ground and my life is still grounded in my Lord. Job then is crying out and pleading with the counselors, would you please give me the gospel? I want this gospel to be true. But we see how we as humans struggle so much to embrace the truth of the gospel and to rest in our Lord. And so quickly we join with Job in saying, my God adversary, my God who's bringing me down, my God who is punishing me, my God who is doing this to me. Rather than crying out to the Lord saying, I do not know why I'm going through this trial, but I only know I can endure this trial by your grace and mercy and your fatherly hand. It is only in your strength that I will endure. This is where the counselor should be pointing Job. This is what Job hopes to be true, and praise be to God that it is true, because our Christ has been raised from the dead. Let us not think our God abandons us in the midst of trial. Let us not think that our God is the one who is this unholy assassin seeking to persecute and punish and harm us, but to see that our God is one who desires to break us of our own sinful desires, our own sinful confidences that we have in ourselves. So we see the beauty and majesty, the glory and the splendor of who he is. May we sojourn through this earth then, seeking him, because we know he is the God, and praise be to him, who seeks, holds, and continues to lead us through this age. Amen.
Thank you for listening to our broadcast. We hope and pray that you were edified through the preaching of the gospel. If you have any questions about our church, please contact our pastor through our webpage, urcbelgrade. That is urcbelgrade.com. We hope to hear from you, and most of all, we hope to see you sojourning and fellowshipping with us each Sunday. Until we meet again, may the Lord's blessing and peace be upon you.